And welcome back to another episode of In a Perfect World. Today is the 1st of August 2017 in my time frame, and this coming interview you're about to hear with Caitlin Thompson was recorded in late May 2017 during the psychedelics conference hosted by Martin Ball in Ashland. So I managed to connect with quite a few people I've been looking forward to chatting with, and got some more very, very interesting psychedelic, shamanic, entheogenic discussions coming up from a lot of the guests that are at the Ashland conference with Martin Ball, exploring psychedelics. And so I am back in America. I am currently in Arizona, around Tucson, and I am helping spearhead the Terra Incognita in Silius Alvarez Toad Conservation and Sustainability Study, which is a bit of a mouthful. But yeah, so my NGO, the Terra Incognita Project, as well as looking at tryptamine neuroscience and how we can document, learn from, and entrain ourselves endogenously and with legal 5-MeO medicine when we do work in Mexico. We've been sponsoring some neuroscience explorations on before and after EEG readings of the brain of people experiencing the toad medicine. We're also talking with some EEG researchers to look at some legal pilot studies that might happen in the US on people that have experienced the medicine separately, and looking at ways of neurofeedback and entrainment and ways that might be activated or documented in people that have experienced that. But as well as doing all that, the current push at the moment is to really help bring awareness to the Bufo alvarius, or the Incilius alvarius toad, which does contain 5-MeO-DMT in its parotoid glands. And last year, the Terra Incognita Project helped conduct a grassroots study looking at toad populations, environmental factors on the ground in the Sonoran Desert in Mexico. And this year we're working with stakeholders on the ground in Arizona, looking at the toad in its native habitats here. We're especially looking at some of the concerns that environmentalists and herpetologists have raised with us in our outreach, looking at an amphibian virus called chytrid, which affects many amphibians throughout the world. And because the Bufo alvarius toads are very popular now, and I must admit, you know, my own documentary, which you can watch at shamansoftheglobalvillage.com, episode one was looking at Octavio Rettig and the Sonoran Desert Toad. And, you know, I know of at least six documentaries coming out about the toad imminently as well. And toad and 5-MeO culture is now booming. In fact, it's probably due for another podcast discussion in terms of the cultural issues around its usage, its lineage, or lack thereof, you know, indigenous issues and Western issues of right relationship, best practices, and things like that. But essentially, the toad is potentially handled a lot. It's endangered in its habitat. If it's moved from its habitat at all, it basically will kill it, because it's very, it has a, you know, inbuilt relationship with its land, and it can't survive outside of its land. And they're very delicate as a species, and so lots of Westerners are now interested in the toad and have heard about that. And this is the time for this medicine to come into the world again, but it needs right relationship, right balance, and right duty of care. So the Terra Incognita Project is actually ongoingly fundraising. You can make a donation through PayPal to contact@terra-incognita-project.org. That's our PayPal address. And we are helping initiate a citizen science campaign for people who live in the area around Arizona, who may go out each season looking for toads themselves to look at toad populations and conduct some more longer-term studies over many years. And we're also doing some research on the potential viral infections in the habitat. So please, you can support that. That's why I'm in Arizona at the moment. You can also contact me at rakrazam@gmail.com if you're interested in some legal retreats in Mexico coming up in the month of August with the Bufo alvarius medicine. And this shamanic culture is, as I say almost every month, and I'm in contact with people all over the world around this, it really is blossoming, and I really feel that we do need to come together. We need to support each other, we need to communicate with each other, we need to share our wisdom, we need to build these relationships if we are going to become a global shamanic culture, which is on the process to becoming. And as I find in doing this NGO work and this community work, it's a lot of politics. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of unforeseen things. It's not necessarily glamorous, and it's not necessarily easy. It's building relationships. And so please, let's all build relationships as best we can. Let's support each other and our shamanic explorations and our relationships with the earth and all the peoples of the earth. And this maybe brings me around full circle to looking at this month's episode, an incredibly juicy conversation with my friend Caitlin Thompson, who lives in San Diego, is one of the linchpins for the San Diego Aware Project, as we're about to find out, which was founded by Ashley Booth, another good friend in Los Angeles. And these community containers for these discussions and integrations are really important. So this episode is all about the microbiome, about psychedelics and tryptamines and our nervous systems and our mind-body spirits. And it raises a lot of very interesting questions, which I hope you enjoy. So I am Rak Razam. You can find me out there. Please support this podcast. You can just PayPal rakrazam@gmail.com. Any contribution helps this show continue to be on the air and helps support me to do this work. So in that spirit of interdependence, I love you all, and I'll see you next month. Aloha. So Caitlin, what was your entry into this blooming, blossoming psychedelic renaissance that we find ourselves in now?
Yeah, it all kind of started when I was 18 and was exploring the rave scene and taking MDMA. And I really grew a lot, and I felt like really excited about the connection to community that I was experiencing, and I had never really felt that before. And as I kind of, you know, grew up and evolved, I transitioned to the psychedelics and the Burning Man culture. And again, really, really excited about this sense of community belonging that I think a lot of people are seeking. Mm-hmm. And my background was in neurobiology. And so while I was in college studying that, I was exploring a lot with psychedelic medicines. And I found that they were kind of inspiring me and intriguing me to be more interested in biology and science. So in some way, maybe they had an agenda. I don't know. Maybe they were making me interested in science so that I could study them someday.
Who's the they? The psychedelics?
The psychedelics, yeah.
Interesting. Okay, wait, tell me, what is neurobiology? Is that what you said?
Yeah. So it's basically biology, but specifically of the nervous system.
Huh.
So, yeah.
Well, that's a definition, but
biology.
Tell me more about that. That sounds really exciting.
More about, like what do you want to know?
Well, what do they study? What do they learn? How does the nervous system work?
Yeah, so you learn about, nerve cells or neurons, brain cells. There's a lot of different names for them. But basically cells that are part of the nervous system, the central nervous system or the peripheral nervous system. And you learn about neurotransmitters that are signaling molecules that the nervous system employs to send messages and electrical currents across, neural networks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how our body runs. It communicates via these nervous system networks. So it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, and so what are some of the things that happen when that nervous system networks go wrong or they're not communicating properly?
A lot of things. I would say most disease states have some element of that, or if they're not caused by it. But yeah, the nervous system is very sensitive, and it kind of controls the whole show.
Mm.
So when the nervous system's unhealthy, then you start to see problems in all areas of the body because it's directly responsible for controlling certain processes in the body, like digestion or, you know, the endocrine glands or, you know, reproduction and all that stuff.
Ah. So how did that lead you, or what's the connection of that sort of body of knowledge to what you're doing nowadays?
Yeah, so I think as I got deeper into psychedelic medicines, you know, I kind of encountered some of my own health challenges, and I found that psychedelics were providing me a lot of relief, and I realized I wasn't the only one, and so I kind of became obsessed with understanding the science of psychedelics, because I was in college studying, you know, biology, and I was just deeply fascinated, and in some ways I just kind of was motivated to heal myself, and so that gave me opportunity to continue to educate myself by reading a bunch of papers and such.
So what is the current state of understanding of how psychedelics might affect the neurobiology of people?
What's the current understanding?
Like, because most of the, when we hear psychedelic science, most of it seems to be, you know, what we're legally able to do in the current culture, like, you know, the MAP-sponsored stuff from, you know, Hefner Institute or the Beckley Foundation.
Yeah.
You know, but it's usually like, okay, if you're clinically ill, you've got cancer, you're dying with terminal illness and anxiety for about death, we'll give you some psilocybin or have a mystical state here or there.
Right.
But I mean, the science of psychedelics seems to be brain-related to MRI and EEG at the moment, and looking at what areas of the brain are being affected, but they're still not really integrating the brain-body dynamic, are they, with psychedelics?
Right. No, and part of the problem is it's like clinical research is so difficult to do because it's expensive. It's hard to get DEA, FDA approval. There is a number of like in vitro studies going on where they're looking at the mechanisms of some of these psychedelic compounds, and I do believe that they are kind of increasing the amount of rat studies that are happening, but yeah, clinical, you know, human studies, they're still not as prolific as they probably should be. But I just gave a talk today actually on psychedelics as a novel approach to autoimmune conditions, and based on some of the in vitro, you know, petri dish evidence and anecdotal stories, and also our understanding of which receptors are being activated and how those play a role in other scientific studies, there is a lot of pretty substantial evidence that psychedelics could be immune modulating and inflammation modulating as well.
So I've read two studies that look at the role of tryptamines, and there's only two that I've found in the scientific literature saying exactly that, that there could be a possible, a verifiable role, and I guess this is with rats, or obviously not with humans, but with immunomodulation and reducing inflammation, and that essentially, you know, the tryptamine cascade that happens in the brain, if you're taking something externally to add to your endogenous levels, or if you're having a natural endogenous experience, but it then cascades and mediates through the endocrine system, like it activates the endocrine system. You know anything about that?
I mean, that's part of the equation. Like, you know, and my talk was quite broad, because when you really look at what's going on with psychedelics that could be relevant to the immune system and inflammatory processes, there is so many different angles that someone could take and look at and say, yeah, that's probably happening. So I think it's multifaceted. You know, certainly some of the literature reviews that you described looking at psychedelics as these immune modulators, they're based off of a bunch of different literature and evidence in animal models and, in you know, cell petri dishes and stuff.
When they do cell petri dishes, is it with human cells or rat cells?
Well, it depends. It depends on the study. But usually it's human if they're trying to make it relevant to human beings.
Yeah, so I didn't know that, but I thought, you know, no human studies unless it's got the FDA approval, but with human cells in a petri dish.
Right, that's different. Yeah.
Right.
So it's a lot easier to get approval to, you know, put drugs in a petri dish and see how they bind to the receptors on that cell, because it's not, there's not like ethical concerns really. So there's plenty of research like that happening, and that's really where people are drawing their inferences from. And unfortunately, we don't seem to have any clinical studies happening right now that are looking at this yet. I heard a rumor that I think is it Johns Hopkins. I know they're doing a microdosing study, but someone told me that they were specifically looking at immune modulation. So it'll be exciting to see what emerges in the next few years, because I think it's a pretty hot topic given the rise in incidences of autoimmune issues in the world. And
so what's behind the rise in autoimmune issues? Is it diet? Is it lifestyle? Is it stress? Is it
I think it's
Western
a number
culture?
Of factors. I think there's a lot of reasons that we are seeing like a increased prevalence of these things. When it comes down to it, like what causes a chronic autoimmune condition is a chronic stressor. And, you know, we're exposed to all these toxins in our environment, in the pillows we sleep on, in the food we eat, in the air we breathe. And, you know, that's creating like a toxic load on our bodies. And we live in a toxic society. And so we're having these, you know, chronic stress experiences on a regular basis. And, you know, there's an increased use of antibiotics, which are wiping out people's microbiomes, and, you know, pesticides on our food that are also killing off our microbiomes, and a rise of infectious organisms that seem to be coping quite well with the climate changes that are happening in the world. So there's a lot of factors, but in the end, I think that we're just getting to a point where there are so many toxic assaults stressing our bodies out and causing the expression of these autoimmune pathologies.
So it's almost like a warning sign for us to understand that our environment is toxic, and because it's all interconnected and affecting us, Look at the warning signs and make changes, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at what an autoimmune disease is, it's basically the body attacking itself. The immune system is attacking healthy tissue and it's causing problems. And it, you know, shows up in a variety of organ systems and symptomology, but the etiology is the same. The origins are the same. And it always comes back to this chronic stressor event that just sends the body out of whack. And I think we really need to look at, like, the fact that our body is attacking itself. It's almost like a metaphor for this world, you know, like we're self-sabotaging our own species, and it's pathetic. And I see human beings almost as like a candida overgrowth to the earth. So like, I feel like the fact that we're all getting these autoimmune conditions is really just a fractal representation of what's happening on a macro scale in the earth and the environment.
Well, speaking about this, now you talked about the microbiome and stuff. I'm really interested to hear about this. I read somewhere recently that one of the key causes of inflammation in different areas of the body can be from the microbacteria.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me for people, the listeners that don't know, what are microbacteria? What is our biome, our stomach biome?
Yeah, so it's basically an ecosystem of various types of organisms that live there. There's bacteria, archaea, you know, fungi, maybe even parasites. Viruses seem to be implicated in it too, and it's like it's almost like its own little world.
It's a microcosm, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. It's just like our Earth, you know. And
it's like that episode of Rick and Morty where they go down into the subatomic world, and then they become kings. You know, then they go down. There's a subatomic world of the subatomic world. And then those life forms, but those life forms have a whole ecology, a life system.
Yeah, just like the rainforest or something, you know, or the earth.
Well, that's what they say, isn't it? You know, we can get to this, but, you know, our current modern usage of antibiotics, which destroys populations of potentially good microbacteria.
Yeah.
If you use the rainforest analogy, it's like we're just chopping down the trees,
which
has repercussions, you know, in the oxygenation cycle and everything.
Yeah, and then, you know, species start to overgrow while others get wiped out because they're being dominated by species that don't belong there, maybe. And it's all very relevant to macroecology.
Mm.
And it's it basically, our microbiome dictates our state of health, and more so than really anything else at this point. And, you know, diet is related to that, because your diet influences what microbes live there, because they eat certain foods, just like, you know, different animals do.
So let me think about this. There's a word for this syndrome where it's like there's a virus or there's a microbacterial creature which gets into a mouse or a rat and makes it get eaten, like controls it.
Yeah.
To the point that it will go up to the cat.
Right.
And offer itself up.
Like so the
toxoplasmosis.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And so it's like it's mind bending, right?
Yeah.
That these microorganisms can basically figure out that there's a food chain that it needs to go up the scale of,
totally.
And influence the organism to the degree that it can actually kill itself, essentially, to...
Yeah, we see a lot of examples of that in nature. And you know, there's been studies done that show that our human, you know, gut flora can influence what type of foods we crave. So, you know, if you're craving sugar all the time, it's because some bug that really likes sugar wants you to keep eating it, and so it rewards you. They're actually producing neurotransmitter that are being released when you give them sugar so you'll keep feeding them.
So when we're, say, having sugar, it's not that our bodies are having a natural, like, some endorphin or reward mechanism for the sugar. It's the microbacteria giving us the reward mechanism.
I mean, it could be both. Like, I can't say that those are separate, but I know that for sure organisms are rewarding us for eating foods that they like.
I wonder how they reward us, though. It's like,
well, through neurotransmitters, yeah.
So they help release the neurotransmitters?
They do, and they are largely responsible for making most of our neurotransmitters.
Because serotonin is mainly produced in the gut, which is a major neurotransmitter.
Yeah, and that's facilitated in large by gut bacteria.
So I'm just having these really randomized thoughts. It's like when, I remember in India, when, you know, women have like a sex strike, right? When in villages and they have cooperation models, when they're trying to have a political influence by, you know, but I'm imagining microbacteria on the same level, like having a serotonin strike, right? And it's like, right, unless you give us what we want, we're not going to produce more serotonin. It's like this really intimate level of cooperation or parasitical sort of.
Yeah, it's manipulative in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it really comes down to balance, because a certain strain of microbe might have a very, you know, a place in your microbiome at a certain population level, but then maybe it starts to get a little overgrown. Maybe you're eating a lot of sugar. Maybe you've been stressed and that's favoring that organism, and they start growing and get to a point where they actually become pathogenic. And so some strains, even though they belong there, they can grow to a point that they're actually considered an infection.
You know, this whole conversation we have about, like, microbacteria, I just keep thinking of humans. Like, don't you? It's like we start to see the scale of things.
Uh-huh.
And as we start to focus on the micro level, we can see that we live in the macro level. But then you get into, like, galactic level or inner space or shamanic. It just keeps going up scales.
Yeah.
But it's like I almost feel like we're out of, you know, we're a rogue macro organism in the Gaian, you know, biome.
Human beings are like a candida infection.
We're like a candida infection. That's so true.
And we're like fucking everything up. We're inhibiting the organisms around us and taking over the resources and saying they're all mine.
So I have two things. Let me think of this. So what is the natural state of an average human's biome, and has it changed over time?
Ooh, well, I think we're still learning a lot, and it really depends on the individual's genetics and where they are living. Like, for example, a person's microbiome in South America looks a lot different than somebody's microbiome in, you know, like Eastern Europe or something. Like, there's so much variety, and they haven't found like one microbiome that is the microbiome for optimal human health. It largely depends on environmental factors and genetics.
Mm.
So yeah, they're still figuring it out. You know, I don't know if you've heard of fecal transplants.
I was leading up to that.
Yeah.
Fecal matter transplants.
They're FMT. Promising with DMT, is that what you
FMT. Said?
Oh.
Fecal matter transplant.
They're promising therapy, but it's still newly developed. And
so wait, so people know. Okay, so say you have a depopulated microbiome, and there's good biome you're missing and bad ones that are in there.
Yeah.
As opposed to, and you're working to maybe improve your diet, but it's not working. There's an overpopulation or an imbalance, and as perhaps not a last resort or like this intervention,
mm-hmm.
you take fecal matter,
poop pills
from, and they say babies are the best because they have the healthiest population and microbiome from maybe a good clean country.
Yeah.
I don't know, and you insert that fecal matter up into your chamber, and then it repopulates from. How does it repopulate backwards from the anus, right?
Well, I mean, bacteria travel, you know? Yeah, they travel. So, I mean, we take probiotics, which are a lot further away from where they really need to be than the anus.
Where do probiotics need to be?
Well, I would say most of the organisms are in the large intestine, in the colon.
Oh, so it's not the stomach at all.
No, and a lot of them actually get destroyed in the stomach.
And the acids.
Yeah, and the small intestine is relatively sterile compared to the large intestine. So most often when people have a bacterial overgrowth, it's in the small intestine. But really, where they belong is the large intestine. So rectum is not too far off from, you know, direct target.
I do not even really... it's embarrassing. I do not really even know my bodily geography. I'm trying to remember where the small and large... I thought they were above the stomach. You're saying they're below, on the way down to the anus?
Yeah, the small intestine is first. Yeah, and then the large intestine is like the lower part, the last.
And so it's like a gradation thing. So, you know, you're eating food, it's going through your body, it breaks down with the stomach acids.
Yeah.
And then it's like, it's this gradation thing. So you go through the car wash and then you go through the clean. So what's the small intestine doing after the stomach's broken down the food?
I mean, I assume absorbing it in some way. Like, I'm not really an expert on what happens in detail at each part of the GI process.
How odd. We have a small intestine and then a large intestine. So nature's built it for there's some differentiation in the what it's doing in one to the other.
I mean, maybe that's where the bile and stuff gets added. I don't really know. I'm not an expert at anatomy either. So.
Mm. All right, so ideally there's an optimal biome, but it can vary according to genetics and culture and so forth and so on. But we do know that there's more beneficial, there's good bacteria and bad bacteria.
Yeah.
You mentioned some before.
Yeah,
but what are the...
there's some strains that they're seeing, like, you know, people with illnesses tend to be deficient in, or, you know, we certainly know what the pathogenic strains are. And
what are some of those?
So I know like the Firmicutes, I can't recall the names. They tend to ferment a lot of these, you know, saccharide molecules, polysaccharides, and cause, you know, gas and bloating and intestinal distress and maybe even inflammation. And those tend to be high in people that are not healthy. Mm. And then I know there's like... you know, Bacteroides, and, you know, unfortunately I'm not really an expert at all these different, like, taxonomic names of things, but I know that they have identified certain, you know, subtypes of bacteria that tend to be good bacteria, and others that tend to cause problems. And so a lot of probiotics are, you know, the good bacteria, so the lactobacillus strains, the... you know, coagulase and stuff like that. Like,
cool. I may have mentioned this before to listeners, but I have a DMT related, you know, microbiome story, which has actually really helped shape a lot of my larger cosmology about the interaction. Because again, what really interests me about this, when we're talking about microbiome, this, as we said, this ecology, you know, and it's like this idea, this understanding that we are a colony organism. We have this sense of individuation and ego and identity. And yes, all that's going on, and yes, you see the physical body, but there's trillions of microbacteria that live in your body that if they were all wiped out, we would die, wouldn't we?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
like
we can't digest food properly without them.
So we are in permanent symbiosis with these invisible microbacteria, other entities, except they can't live without us or another host body, but we can't live without them.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
So essentially... we're in a symbiotic relationship, and we're not just individual, you know, we're a colony organism. So I've heard it described, which I love that phrase, colony organism.
Yeah.
So sci-fi, right? So 70s. So anyway, so my, just to, you know, try to get this into a more, leading up to the psychedelic interaction with the microbiome. Basically, the last six times I did NMDMT, a couple of years ago now, and it was for 2 years, you know, over a course of 2 years, just sporadically here and there. But each single time it just started that, well, it sat me up, like I'm, you know, lying down, I've smoked N,N-dimethyltryptamine, and then as the visionary state would start to come on, the first time it happened, I'm completely lying down, it sat me up, and my hands came together into like a mudra position, and it literally was like so fast, like a wheel, turning at about 100 revolutions a second, and I'm going like, what the fuck? Right? And, but like my consciousness was there, yet my body was doing this thing autonomously of its own, and it was a normal thing. Anyway, it happened over the course of a couple of years, six times. And I started to see or tune in amongst the fractaling, you know, dimethyltryptamine sort of dimensionality, these little white antibodies, spermy type things, but clustering around me like an airbag of high consciousness. And then I'd start to realize that they were the ones doing it, but they didn't feel separate from me. I've never had really that many separate entity encounters. I just sort of don't get to that. But over time, it got to the point where they would literally pick up my right hand and they would tap my left hand. I remember this distinctly. And I'd be like, oh, there you are. It's you guys. And I'd tune into them. They go, you ready? And then they'll start to do the mudras. And it felt like eventually, I started to get researching microbiomes at this time. I started to like piece these two things together. And maybe it's a story, but this is what it felt like. It felt like they were doing the calibration test on a printer. And there was something around the mudras and the asanas and the positions of the body that helped the electromagnetic body assume configuration and have a reset setting. But the really interesting thing was, is that it felt like an iceberg with 9/10, you know, that we see on the astral. We think of ourselves, you know, Doctor Strange, sci-fi movies, there we are in our physical body on the astral being just our individual entity. But I really understood, it felt like this was my stomach biome communicating with me on the astral. And I was like, oh, you know, that, wow. Like, wow. What do you think of, like, microbacteria on the astral?
Yeah. I mean, like we've talked about before, I think the whole concept and all the things that we're learning about the microbiome really begs the question, you know, where does the self begin and where does it end? Because, you know, we have these microorganisms that are clearly required for our survival, therefore, does that make them separate or does that make them a part of us? And I think you really kind of hit the nail on the head in calling it a colony organism, because I believe that they contribute to our consciousness and are a part of how we identify as a separate being.
So the really interesting question now is, if we agree on that level of discussion, we know that we've said that they can have certain drivers for sugar, for cravings and reward mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
Could they be potentially also engaged in a reward drive mechanism on a spiritual level, in the sense that, okay, here's where I'm just tuning into it now. We have a mutual colleague in San Diego, Dr. Michael Villanueva. I always pronounce it wrong.
Villanueva.
Yeah, who works at the Alpha Theta Center. Anyway, 5-MeO research legally in Mexico, yada, yada, yada. The point is, we have three brain structures, or so some fringe science I've read has said, in the sense we have the stomach gut instinct brain.
Uh-huh.
I'm just calling them brains, right? Three brains. Stomach gut brain, heart brain with neuronal cells, and then the normal brain structure. When, for instance, on 5-MeO, frontal lobes go completely offline, sense of identity, consciousness is still there, but sense of identity and ego is completely gone, flatlined into the unity 5-MeO source consciousness. But potentially, older networks remain and are receiving the broadcast signal of consciousness, which the heart picks up as completely unconditional love radiating in superunion. But then, what are the stomach biome bacteria doing, for instance, in a 5-MeO or other altered psychedelic experience? Do they play a role in the cravings, reward mechanisms, and drives of us connecting to higher dimensional sources? Do they receive the signal?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of possibility that they do, and this is something that I've wondered myself, because we look at these psychedelics, they're, you know, they're tryptamines, which are really highly conserved molecules that have, you know, every basic life form utilizes tryptamines. I mean, tryptophan, you know, is an amino acid, and virtually any life form that has any sort of metabolism utilizes tryptophan.
Mm.
And so, clearly, you know, these bacteria have some reason or, you know, some purpose for producing these neurotransmitter tryptamine compounds like serotonin.
Yeah, why do they produce these things, right, which are so essential to consciousness itself?
Yeah. So who's to say that they're not also being affected by the psychedelic medicine and having their own spiritual experience or awakening inside of you, a part of you?
I'm thinking of Rick and Morty again. You've got to see this episode, right? I'm imagining these, like, this you know, this ecology of life forms which have, if you could drill down to that level and see them under electron microscope as, you know, whatever entities.
Yeah.
And they're producing the tryptophan and the serotonin, don't they? Or do they? Yeah.
And they help which convert we need to glutamate have our... to GABA.
Oh, like, my God.
They're very psychoactive. And so that's why I wonder what their effect is like being exposed to psychedelic compounds.
Well, because we were just talking about this, the immunomodulation and the decrease in inflammation. So if we take a psychedelic compound, it's, well, the tryptamines at least go through the serotonin pathways.
Yeah.
And they're all entangled.
Most of the receptors are in the gut.
Most of the receptors are in the gut. So we know that from that end down, the psychedelics can be having an effect on the serotonin pathways, on the endocrine system, on the body, and potentially the microbacteria in the biome.
Yeah.
But in a wonderful sort of circle of life there, the microbiome is producing the endogenous things we need to have these psychedelic...
Yeah, totally. Oh,
I'm blown away by this.
I know, it's very interesting.
Wow.
Who designed that?
So how do we get like... I want more and more... We're at conferences like Exploring Psychedelics, and we were at MAPS together as well, and... You know, there's this wonderful, what we're calling psychedelic renaissance, this term that's around. And it's not just in the scientific studies, the quite limited ones that are still permissible under the Western culture, but it's this sense of community and of coming together almost in a psychedelic biome, right? But with all this potential, I'm like, well, can't we just initiate some study amongst the community? Go, right, let's go into psychedelic studies and try to communicate with our biome. Can we have like this, like, I don't know, cultural exchange program with our microbiome, like mediated through psychedelics?
Hello,
now we're talking.
I had a really intimate conversation with them. I said, all right, guys, you guys are a little rowdy down there. I know not everybody's getting along, and I'm, you know, getting the shitty end of the stick. Is it all good?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I actually had a conversation with them, and I asked them to... you know, please sort it all out and just get along with each other and stop fighting with each other and find peace in the right ratios that they belonged in. And I could feel that it was actually an accepted request. They kind of received it and said, okay, yeah, I think we can do that. And yeah, it was really interesting.
That's wonderful. I mean, I think if in shamanic culture we can like, conceptualize plants having a spiritual nature and identity, an autonomous, you know, identity and cohesion, yeah. There then if we apply that to our own colony, yeah. Organism, the microbiome, and then start to have a relationship with them that's not just I'll feed you good things, but in our spiritual journeying, connecting with ourselves and our health and mind, body, spirit, and invoking the microbiome.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that you really nailed it. Like, if there's plant spirits and if there's, you know, mushroom spirits, why couldn't there be bacteria spirits or parasite spirits, you know, like, that are also intelligent?
Well, I mean, this is really opening up new levels of thought for me. It's really, it feels really rich in possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of your other thoughts around this nexus point potentially between... Well, you talked about ayahuasca. What are we thinking? I mean, ayahuasca, and we talked about how different cultures have different biomes according to the health. And traditionally, in Amazonian culture, ayahuasca, you know, was taken... If it was taken for a psychedelic or psychoactive enhancement by the shaman to work on behalf of the patient, but if the patient was to take ayahuasca, it was usually... in the older cultures, just the vine, and it was as a purgative to clean out the yeah, bad bacteria.
Totally.
So there's a really entangled relationship, intimate relationship with ayahuasca working as a purgative and connecting to the microbiome.
Yeah, totally. I just presented today on the fact that harmine seems to...
This is the perils of experiential journalism. Listeners, see if you can pick what that sound is.
Yeah. All right. I just presented today and touched on the fact that there's some scientific research that looks at harmine, which is the MAOI, or an MAOI in ayahuasca, and it seems to be antimicrobial and antifungal, and specifically antiviral against the herpes simplex 2 virus. So I think
is that the latent one, or is that the?
That's the one HPV. That's typically genital herpes.
Oh right, yeah. Really?
It can happen like on your mouth and stuff too, but that's the one that usually is on the genitals and stuff. So would
that be topically or by drinking it?
Well, I mean.
What does that do then? So it kills off the virus on the inside that's exhibiting on the outside?
Well, I think the study was, again, in a petri dish. So all they know is that when it comes into direct contact with the virus, it kills it. So we don't know if clinically that would translate. So if you drink ayahuasca, we just don't know if that would kill a bunch of herpes virus. That's why we need human studies to validate and verify the things that we see in these petri dish studies for animals.
So in your experience with, psychedelics or shamanic sort of entheogens and the relationship to health, what are your thoughts on the other relationships that they, engender within us and the connection to the microbiome, perhaps?
As far as health or spiritual?
Well, I just interviewed Joe Tufour earlier this morning with some beautiful ambient background sounds in the previous episode, as listeners will attest. And we were talking a lot about, his path as a Western-trained medical doctor and then the Shipibo-trained ayahuasca path and what is sickness and what is health and this understanding and the indigenous cosmovision of energy body, emotional body, physical body. And I'm really excited about this microbiome stuff. I'm thinking, because it's got the physical component, but we also know with the endocrine system and the other things how it's all connected.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, we just talked about ayahuasca, and I know that the tryptamines, there's two research studies on the immunomodulation and how that flushes clean in the body and how they could be working. And we're talking about serotonin. I'm just wondering, I wonder what some of the other psychedelics might be doing to that microbiome.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. and we don't really know. I don't think anybody's looked at that, really. And I do know that our emotional state does affect our microbiome.
Really?
So, for example, stress can... Stress, of the nervous system can send signals down to the gut and actually change the environment of the microbiome and influence what type of organisms will proliferate. So if you're under a lot of stress or whatever, that is directly going to influence and shift the microbial populations quite quickly, actually. I think within like a day or so.
Really?
Yeah.
Because on their time scales, that's probably like 10,000 years.
Yeah, well, they reproduce, they go from like one cell to a million in 8 hours. So bacteria are multiplying extremely fast. I know that emotional states that could cause distress are probably directly related to the microbiome. And, say your dog gets hit by a car or something and dies and you're super depressed about it, that's probably going to influence your microbial population, which in turn could influence your health, which could keep you depressed for longer. It's like none of these things are separate from each other. They all influence each other in a bi-directional matter.
Wow. Okay. What else have you got for me? So what else did you cover in your talk here today?
Yeah, so I talked a little bit about how activation of the serotonergic system, which is mostly what the psychedelics are, binding to, we know from thousands of papers that serotonin plays a huge role in immune modulation. And so there's some evidence that, activation of the 5-HT2A receptor is modulating the immune responses and inflammation by changing calcium, levels in the cell, which downstream affects the release of transcription factors such as nuclear factor kappa B or mitogen activating protein kinase. And those transcription factors basically dictate which genes are expressed, including genes that might produce pro-inflammatory cytokines. So when you kind of like look at, this cascading effect that happens just from
the serotonergic system activation, or like the sigma 1 receptor, they affect the expression of these genes that ultimately decide how inflamed your body is going to be.
I'm just digesting that one. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's like,
and this is all, it's wow. speculative because, wow. because it's happening, again, in a petri dish. But the evidence is pretty substantial that this is likely occurring in vivo as well, in people's bodies. So it'd be great to see some research happen on this pretty soon. Actually, if anybody's interested, I would love to partner with somebody to make this research happen. So for all you listeners.
Wow. Okay. So I'm a bit mind blasted by that. I'm just trying. What I get from that is this intimate interrelation between these gradiated bits of the body and, I mean, even the emotional body. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mind-body connection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, like I said, you know, emotions affect the nervous system, and the nervous system runs the show. All these neurotransmitters play some mysterious role in immune modulation and digestion and metabolism.
What are the other neurotransmitters?
Well, there's like dopamine, norepinephrine, acetylcholine, glutamate, DMT.
DMT, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, I hear it's trippy.
Yeah.
Someone told me.
Wow. Is there a developing sort of field of science that is looking at all of this? You said there needs to be more studies, but, you know, are there more studies? Are there?
Well, not on psychedelics necessarily yet, but there is a field called psychoneuroimmunology.
Oh.
Where they're looking at the effect of how do I put this? I just hold it. There we go. They are looking at the effect of, emotional components to the nervous system and how that affects the immune system, because they're all very much interrelated and influence each other.
Mm.
So, and there's also psychoneuroendocrine immunology. Like, they're just keep adding words in there because they keep finding that all these things are related.
Yeah, wow. So there are people working on this.
Yeah, certainly looking at the immune system and the nervous system. But yeah, it seems like there's been only a handful of people that have started to connect the dots, with psychedelics being pertinent to all of this.
You know, there's some people that they say they have like high or low tolerances or thresholds to say DMT. And they wonder what their... James Orrock's one of these. He's like, really hard nut to crack. It's like to break through. And I'm just wondering, you know, do we think this is psychological or some type of, you know, that level of something? Or is it microbiome related? Are we producing enough serotonin? You know, people have, with shamanic medicines, the sensitivities... And would that be related to their production of precursor?
It's all related. You know, it's like all of those things contribute to make the state of that being at the time. And so you can't really allocate credit to one or another thing. They're all participating. The microbiome is participating. What you ate that day is participating. Your emotional state, your past, you know, and maybe you don't feel vulnerable. Or you don't feel safe allowing yourself to lose control. And so there's some part of you that's holding, you know, tight to reality. Or it could be that, your microbiome isn't generating a lot of neurotransmitter. Or maybe your genetics and your interaction with the microbiome are making it so you produce a bunch of monoamine oxidase and you're breaking it down faster than the average person. So... there's like just so many variables that collectively pixelate and create the whole picture.
Interesting. So one of the things that you're talking about, the MAO, and I know that like stress, you can produce cortisol as a reaction to that, and that can interfere with the MAO some way in the ayahuasca process.
I mean, it's like dropping a pebble in a pond. Like, it's going to affect every water molecule in the pond. You know, that wave is going to travel, and that's kind of like the human body. Every breath you take has some consequence.
Mm. Wow. So you talked a little bit about ayahuasca. What's your medicine path, and how is that, with the knowledge you have of all this type of you know, stuff. Has that affected the way you see, you know, the work of, say, ayahuasca in the medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. I think ayahuasca is particularly good for inflammatory diseases. You know, it's nice that it goes through the gut, and I do think it kind of helps clean up the microbiome and calm the inflammation in the gut, which the gut is the largest lymphatic organ in the body. It contains like 70% of our immune system. So that's a good place to start if you're having immune inflammation problems. But it also addresses these sort of psychosomatic aspects of disease, you know, by helping us resolve our traumas and blockages that are stopping us from just allowing energy to flow freely through our energetic body. And it's a very multifaceted medicine, which I think is why it's so powerful, because a lot of these Western medicines, they only address one tiny, you know, piece of the puzzle, and really there's a multitude of things that have to be addressed all at once to holistically heal the person. So ayahuasca is a step forward in that, because it is so multifaceted with the psychological and spiritual and biochemical components all kind of coming together.
Wow. And so you mentioned before that, you know, you were talking to your own microbiome.
Yeah, and I felt like we had a good understanding, and unfortunately, shortly after that experience, I had an antibiotic-resistant kidney infection, was in and out of the hospital for a few days, and I had to bomb them with a bunch of really gnarly antibiotics, and I felt awful. I thought, man, I just made friends with these guys, I just made a bargain plea with them, you know, and I'm like, please, can we all just get along and be happy together? And here I am killing them. And I actually took the time to apologize to them, because I felt so bad about it. I felt like I had betrayed them in some way. And I explained to them why I had to do this. And it was for the preservation of their children's children, you know, if bacteria even really have children, I don't know. But yeah, it was an interesting experience. And I felt really bad about having to do that. But yeah, talk to your microbiome, you know, you never know what they'll tell you.
So when people take antibiotics, and obviously sometimes they're necessary, but it's sort of like, you know, Apocalypse Now, napalming in the jungle, isn't it? It's not that it's just killing off the bad. How come they can't figure out a way to just kill off the bad ones and not leave the good ones?
There is a way, it's just not as acutely effective. It takes lifestyle change. Wow. I mean, that's what diet and supplements and, you know, herbs and certain bacteriophages that are implicated in some probiotic strains that they have now. It can be done. It just, you know, anything that is going to be fine-tuned in its completion is probably not going to be, it's not going to happen immediately, you know? Mm. Like, there's just so much complexity to it, and there's a lot of calibration that has to happen. Therefore, it has to occur over time, because even our intelligent bodies can't like do that type of magic. And so antibiotics, they're like super disruptive, super effective for killing, which is what they're good at, but not in a very strategic way. You know, they're kind of just like a giant bomb that goes off, and to do it strategically takes more effort and more patience and more discipline. And most people don't want to do it that way, so.
So, talking about, like, killing off certain of your microbiome, but what about, like, repopulating or accentuating? I wonder if, I mean, you also have a company that makes herbal supplements,
Entheozen,
sorry. But I was thinking about this, what if there's, like, a probiotic-esque, you know, capsule with the right, you know, precursor type stuff, that would help, you know, people going down to do ayahuasca, where it's like you're repopulating certain things, building the right amount of serotonin, or, you know,
well,
like
prebiotics.
But specifically to accentuate the pathways which were going to be activated by, say, tryptamine experiences.
Yeah, well, it's good foreshadowing for a product that I'm working on, and hopefully will be on the market in the next 8 months or so. That's my goal. But, I'm developing a psychobiotic right now, which would be a probiotic supplement that is specifically geared towards optimizing brain and mood health.
Ooh.
And so, yeah, there'll be strains that are really good at, you know, producing neurotransmitters or just catering to a healthy brain that will have an abundance of ability to make neurotransmitter and therefore might make life a little bit more bright and psychedelic. Mm. So that could be relative to what you're describing.
I've seen that in my feeds. I think Aubrey Marcus's company on it, they're producing some type of, like, you know, mind enhancement, probiotic-y type thing.
And
I've seen a few other ones like that as well. Like, it seems to be there's a developing, you know, blend between the marketplace and the culture for supporting the optimization of this type of shamanic or psychedelic experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the field of the microbiome is exploding right now, and everybody's scrambling to get in on it, you know?
You know, I was on a private psychedelic mailing list a few years ago, and Rick Strassman was on this list, and somehow, I'm sure it came from Rick originally, and I'm sure he'd be fine me sharing this with a few million people. but there was the idea that, you know, we're talking about accentuating the precursors for the psychedelic experience with, you know, whatever materials we have here.
Right.
But this idea that maybe we see it was something that you could take out, like, this is different but related, that if you took out the cell of, say, a virus, and then you put in another genetic material, i.e. like a DMT replicating virus or whatever, put in there, but you could almost create like a virus which would replicate and endogenously create more DMT naturally. I'm wondering if the probiotic optimization of these things could get us to peak states where we're creating more natural, you know, tryptamines to help engender our relationship with those high dimensional spaces.
Yeah, well, I think in general, the healthier the brain is, the more neurotransmitters it's going to be able to produce as far as like keeping a healthy balance. And the more, like, psychedelic and bright the world will be for you, like, as far as your perception. So, yeah, we could genetically design some organism probiotic that has a little gene, you know, that just makes copious amounts of DMT or something.
Because that's what I'm asking you to do,
that would
Caitlin.
Be... right? I don't know if I'm qualified.
Huh?
Yeah,
sure, we'll see what we can do. Yeah.
Bugs. Psychoactive bacteria.
Wow. And then we can do the fecal matter transplant, but it'll be like the...
Yeah, DMT.
DMT.
Fecal matter.
Yeah. You're like, well, funny we mentioned this because our friend the Tea Fairy has this whole riff lately about the studies, you know, underground shamanic studies of boofing tryptamines, because the absorption in the rectum bypasses the gut and the MAO and has proven to be anecdotally a very efficient way of transmitting the material and having a long, slow release and a controlling gradation of the journey. And then, wow, if that worked and we could optimize that, we could just create a fecal matter DMT transplant machine.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
The possibilities are endless.
Let's go on Shark Tank.
Oh, my God. And pitch this idea, awesome. All right, so what are your plans? What are you doing? We mentioned your company, Transcend?
Yeah. No, Transcend is the product. Entheozen is the company.
Entheozen, right? Yeah, I know.
People get them all mixed up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so what are my plans? I'm just figuring it out as I go. I think the overarching goal for my life is to provide tools to people, whether that's through actual supplement products or information, so that people can kind of take control of their health and their mental wellness. I think my strongest drive is to just give people access to the information they need to take control of their happiness again. So, yeah, however that looks, whether that's you know, moving forward, conducting psychedelic research, you know, maybe looking at the microbiome or, you know, biomarkers for inflammation, or just producing supplements or doing talks around the world, or I don't know. We'll see where life takes me.
And do you have a website or somewhere people can follow your products?
Yes. So I'm, you know, Entheozen is the name of the company, and the website is www.entheozen.com, and it's spelled the same way as entheogen, just with a Z, as in zebra, instead of the G. So if you type it into Google, I show up because it's a made-up word that I created. So entheozen will pop up first on the page.
Cool. And then there's the Aware Project in San Diego. People can find that.
Yeah. So if you go on the awareproject.org, that will show you, that'll give you access to information about both the LA and San Diego events happening. So feel free to check it out, sign up for the newsletter to get updates. You can also watch the live stream of the events or past videos, you know, if you're not local or if you can't make it to an event. So lots of good content to check out.
Awesome. Caitlin, thank you for this very illuminating talk.
Thank you, Rack, for entertaining me and allowing me to chat with you.
Yeah, awesome. All right, in Lakesh.